Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and I hope everybody, because I don't talk about personal stuff too often, but I hope everybody had a good resurrection, Easter, however you want to associate to it, a Sunday, or call it a day of rest, or just a day off. We have a crisis, and reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. So one of the things that is absolutely paramount is trying to get people equally informed, because the sooner we can do that, the sooner we will get a jump on, you know, getting our government back into compliance with the Constitution. All right, or let's say it this way. Restoring our liberties and our control over our government. As we've been going through the notes on the Constitutional Convention, it was really, really clear that they were very apprehensive in trying to play with any form of property at the federal level. As a matter of fact, there was this apprehension in trying to dictate slavery one way or the other, or to even put it onto the table as an issue. And so there was one of those things that actually became more and more prevalent as a political compromise, because there were a lot of people that just said, we want to do this. But the fact that they made the compromise to respect the repugnance, the abominable concept of a person owning another person, right? That this is fundamental property rights of slavery. Right, wrong, or indifferent, nations had been recognizing slavery for 5,000 years. As a matter of fact, we can't talk about slavery until we really talk about the first society that absolutely reigned with terror and was a dominating force, the longest society that the annals of history of mankind have ever recorded, that operated slavery as long as it did, and that is the Egyptian Empire. So, and we only know on the Bible side the enslavement of those people we call Israel, that the Bible refers to, I should say, as Israel. So when the Constitution, or when these framers actually decided to protect the property of the people, then let me ask you this. Where do you think your physical property that your house sits on? Now, just to be clear, there was nothing in the Constitution giving the federal government any control over any of the land within a state. And then all of a sudden, they just ipso facto said, hey, what we want to do is we want to tell you now, and we're going to do this, we're going to control all minerals within the ground. Nobody owns the minerals. Now, there may be some grandfathered clauses or what have you that they kind of came up with, but they were making it up as they go along. So as we've been covering this, where in the heck do you think there was no concept of that, any kind of control over private property or even state property? As a matter of fact, had that even been included in the state or in the constitutions, the states in their ratification debates would have rejected the Constitution outright. Because bottom line, each of the states, as we're showing you, each of the delegates were there to protect the sovereignty of their states and ensure that they had equal footing in this compact. And they were looking at what they were giving to this general government was going to be very limited and very defined. And that's exactly what happened. So how did we get to this point where we now have, when if you're familiar with the CO2 pipeline plan, I guess I need to put that picture up. Look for the CO2 pipeline plan for America. Folks, when they put these pipelines in, they're coming across your property. Now, there may be some progressives out there that are more than willing to surrender their property rights all for the greater good and say, well, why won't you? Because they don't have the authority to be even doing this. They don't even have the delegated authority to be involved in environmental protection processes, period. Right, wrong, or indifferent, we live by the rule of law, not by the whims and the desires of government and those who govern us. We definitely want to dive into this more and more. But what I want to actually do is, you know, provide to you that, you know, that clarity of how important it is to really see how they were arguing and building and evolving these designs, these initial designs from Madison, and what ended up becoming the ratified Constitution. So before I do that, you know, we're going to continue doing that with reading the notes. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk a little bit about why don't you get involved in becoming a part of Reclaiming the Republic. This is not an organization that you, you know, just find or you create. This is you leading people and getting them to organize. Why do I say that? Because you in your county, in your state, have a right to determine your self-destination, your self-destiny, I should say. And so what we are calling for you to do is to get organized and call yourself whatever you want to call yourself. But you, if you want to preserve your liberties, you need to be very clear in delineating exactly what you want and what you should be wanting, what you should be seeking, should be full compliance of the Constitution. In other words, maintaining and keeping and preserving the rule of law. Remember, our law is king. John Adams stated that, you know, and that was common knowledge. They understood in a republican form of government, it was not designed based on a monarchy. It was based on law. And what ended up happening in Rome and what ended up happening in America is they started wandering. But in Rome, the problem was that the government that was created had general powers. Our government that was created has never had the authority to actually be involved whatsoever in this thing called, you know, environment, education, all of these types of things. There is no defined or granted authority to even create treaties to join us to the UN or to allow them to create agreements with financial institutions to take on debt to spend on public services and or public, you know, institutions, efforts that are not within the Constitution. In other words, all of the money that they're spending on unconstitutional things that they control is not authorized. It's fraud. That entire debt clock, there's no doubt in my mind. I haven't sat down and done the accounting, but get an accountant into the room and they'll just actually come out with this flabbergasted face saying, we should have this much money in, you know, in wealth because they have been spending, we've been taxing and taxing and taxing. And for the amount of money that they're taxing us and for what the amount of money that they're spending, you know, my friend used to call it the gazintas and the gazautas. The gazintas is the taxation and the gazautas is the outlays, what they spend money on. So they're taxing an obscene amount of money, and then it goes out on not just those things that are authorized, a lot of things, the majority of what is being spent is on things that are not authorized. Build Back Better, the TARP bailouts, all of these things for well over a century, going all the way back to the Civil War and actually before that. When the framers, the last of the framers died off, they started getting more and more emboldened and being able, well, we, you know, it's maybe we don't have the power to do it, but it's a good thing to do it, so we ought to do it. And you know what? We got the money to do it. Or we can obtain the debt and then tax for some more. If somebody actually went through the process, because you know what, folks? We actually have a full accounting on some of almost everything that they've done. If you look at some of the petitions, when we actually go back into the Department of Commerce, when we go back into the Department of Interior and all of these different departments, we actually lay out many of the things that they did where they spent money. And all of those things were absolutely unconstitutional. You'd be hard-pressed to find anything within these unconstitutional executive departments that had any association with a constitutional authority to do. So here we are. We're now at this point where we're going, okay, so what are we going to do? What you have to do is you got to get organized. And all you've got to do is just walk down the street, knock on everybody's door in your neighborhood, say, are you okay with this? Are you okay with this? Let me give you some information. And as a matter of fact, you can print out the color-coded constitution and hand that out to people. There's nowhere on that that says, hey, and it's free. I mean, all you've got to do is bear the cost of printing it out in color. It can be kind of a little expensive, but for the most part, you're showing people what parts of the Constitution are being violated. Now, wait till we finish the Table of Tyranny. I was in a call today. We were talking with Bob Schultz, and Bob Schultz was talking about having a really good course on education. And I basically laid it out saying, if you're not teaching the people using a color-coded constitution so that every time they read that clause, they know that that clause is being violated. So they start thinking, well, how is that happening? Now, when we finish this Table of Tyranny, we're going to lay out exactly how that clause is being violated. So that you, and we'll cite this out of the ratification debates or what have you. But bottom line, when you actually put this, shine the spotlight on the Constitution and what they have the authority to do and what each of those clauses really mean, how they were defined by the ratification debates, then you now have, as far as I'm concerned, you have clarity on where you need to go and what you need to do. So my contact information is on there. I just added a contact this week. And so we're happy to, you know, bring in more and more states. Now, if you live in Iowa, if you live in South Dakota, if you live in Wyoming, if you live in Montana, if you live in Georgia, if you live in Virginia, if you live in Missouri, if you live in New York, I mean, that's what, 8 and even more. Now we're actually starting in Ohio. There's a lot of other places, you know, like New Mexico and other places we're trying to actually get moving. So what's holding you up? The only reason why we're going to get to a point where, you know, we're just not going to be able to fire on all cylinders is because not a lot of people have, I'll just say, consecrated or have dedicated their, you know, this amount of time to solving the problem, to actually trying to take back this government. So when we start actually making a commitment and actually start really, you know, saying, I'm going to spend this much time, and you actually start finding that you can spend a little bit more time and a little bit more time, you're going to try to, and I just ask that you try to push it to the limits, you're going to try to actually, you know, if you really care, you're going to try to do these things. And all I'm asking is not to lean on me, but become so profound in understanding the Constitution and how it was defined in the ratification debates to where, you know, we're 90% completely in agreement. The only places that we will not agree on are those places you just haven't read yet, that you haven't become equally informed. And it's not that we disagree. It's about the level of information. Now, there's many a times when I talk to people, like, you know, that whole debt, you know, that's all unconstitutional. They think that's hyperbole. That's because they're so ill-informed. You know, when I get out in public and I make comments like, you know, this treaty with the UN is completely unconstitutional. That's because they are not equally informed. They don't know how the framers defined what that line is, how they clarified the supremacy clause, because that's what they use. They use the supremacy clause because the supremacy clause caveats it right there. It says under their authority. So they can't create a treaty if they don't have the authority to do it. And that means that the authority within the Constitution. So if they go and create a treaty that is doing something that is not something within the Constitution, it's not enumerated, then they can't do it. It's that simple. So anyway, one of the things I wanted to kind of cover today, well, as you reach out and you get involved, test me, prove me wrong that I won't respond, you know, and then light me up if I fail to. There was one point in time, a gal from California contacted me and I got back with her, but I initially reached out to her, but I never got back to her. And so I finally got back to her, you know, like a year or two later with the greatest apologies and saying, you know, I'm sorry I never got back to you. I wish you would have, you know, pinged me or something. And then she said, oh, well, my life went sideways. So that's why I never said anything. And I go, okay, good, because I'm glad you, you know, try to hold me accountable to, you know, getting some information, helping you, what have you. So anyway, what I want to do is there's a couple of issues that are really, really important, because some of this is like property, right? Intellectual property, right? And when you put intellectual property out into the public domain, you know, this kind of, you know, creates an avenue or an opportunity, I'll say, to actually give you the ability to monetize your intellectual property. And the Constitution gives the government the right to basically create, this is in Article 1, Section 8, a uniform rule on copyrights. Actually, what it says, now let me see here, to promote, this is subsection 7, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by secure, so in other words, you know, to help promote inventors, you know, science and those types of things, then they want the federal government has the ability for basically securing to the people limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writing and so forth. Now, what does that limited times mean? And so what we need to do, and that, well, we can go through the ratification base, but I'm here to tell you, when you look at the initial copyrights that they had, those copyrights were not for a lifetime. And as a matter of fact, you know, the intent was to maintain and promote people to continually create and create and create. If you create a perpetual patent on something that is fundamentally necessary, you know, like a water pump and or, you know, some of these devices and designs that have actually, you know, exceeded their patent rights. And that's why a lot of different companies have innovated and created their own little, you know, but what they do is they patent, you know, some little thing that they add to it or what have you. But the point is this is to help elevate society. It's not to ingratiate and basically line the pockets of the inventor. Again, this whole starts off with to promote the progress of science and useful arts. This has nothing to do with making people rich. It's to help people feel like, hey, if I invent something, I can make some money off of it. So the concept of an artist like Eric Clapton to basically write a song and perform that song and put it onto, you know, onto some medium, whether it be vinyl, digital, what have you, and make money by you buying that if you want to have that, and making that copyright perpetual for in time, for all time and eternity, so that he can now, because this is what the artists are doing today, because these copyrights are so unreasonably long, these artists are actually getting away with selling their rights before they die into kind of like a trust or over to somebody else to create a trust for someone else. And I'm going, hold on here. That was never the intent, to create this elitism, because you created one thing. It's what it does is it takes away the idea of promoting more and more innovation, more entertainment, because actually when we really look at songs, it is art. Okay, I get that. It's art. But does it really contribute to the betterment of society in such ways, as profound ways as possible, you know, remedies of, you know, healing somebody, or ways of, you know, being able to become more productive? I mean, come on. And if you really look at how this is almost like the ancient Greek part two, because when you looked at the ancient Greek, they started becoming overcome by the performing arts as well. I mean, when you read Plato's Republic, he talks about how influential the performing arts were in helping people become, you know, indoctrinated into, you know, these precepts, concepts, theories, paradigms, what have you, in getting people to kind of align with that. Oh, I like that song. And with that song, and I'll just refer back to an old Edgar Winter song, Save the Planet. You know, say, it's a gospel tune. I've played it on this show a few times, and it's a gospel tune that's, you know, kind of catchy, but, you know, save the planet. Who will save the planet? You know, and I'm going, come on. You know, here's a song that is actually an indoctrination. How is that in betterment? Oh, well, is it noble to say we should save the planet? Or is it more noble to say we need to be productive and find harmony? You know, does the planet really need to be saved? I mean, if that's the case, then we should eradicate every volcano, because the volcano, every time they erupt, they do harm to any form of life on this planet, right? So let's go and cap, and let's make all volcanoes extinct. And let's look at the ramifications of trying to do that, because they're the number one polluters. As a matter of fact, one good volcano eruption will outproduce pollutants and particulates put into the air, causing more harm than years and years of people, what we're doing with our own exhaust and everything else. And so my point is that when we look at trying to stop a volcano, the consequences of that, because, but we'd have to cool the magma and keep the magma cooled. Well, maybe the consequences of that is this: the Earth wouldn't be rotating as fast as it is, and maybe things would start slowing down, and maybe it would lose some of its, I'll just say, force to maintain its space, its gravity space, from the sun. And it may actually change the origins, or I should say our path of our orbit around the sun. I mean, when we start playing with things of science and nature that we don't even understand, because, oh, we think that's a good thing. Well, we better be careful with what we're doing, because there are consequences. There are deliberate consequences to, you know, our actions. And if we're not careful, we will actually rue the day that we even did what we did. That happens all the time. That absolutely happens. Look at asbestos. Look at all of the things that have come forth, and how the consequences of some of those things, because we didn't understand what this was going to do. Because remember, results take time to measure. So when we come back, I'm going to talk about the magistrate and that, common law.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so what I want to do is I kind of want to cover some what I think are pretty important aspects of the magistrate paradigm. Because there's lots of people out there that are clinging to this, you know, this sheriff being the magistrate, the doctrine of lesser magistrate. And so what I want to do is I actually want to help you understand why this paradigm is not a good paradigm. And so what we need to do is we really need to focus on common law and the origins of common law. Common law under the British monarch at the time of the revolution was a theocratic monarchy. In other words, that form of government was a theocratic monarchy where the king obtained his authority to rule his subjects through a coronation process done by the highest priesthood. And I believe it was the Archbishop of Canterbury. And so this Archbishop of Canterbury was the same person that had spiritual dominion over those same subjects. So in other words, it was like a Mutt and Jeff type of situation, magistrate, right? Where the law and the execution and all of that, the bad guy was the king. And the archbishop was the one who blessed everybody, but he had the ability to excommunicate and, you know, have the king actually, you know, by the laws that the king has created, make life pretty miserable for those people who were not toting their, you know, their load for the church. So in Britain, in the very beginning of this form of government, you got to understand that it was under the Roman rule. In other words, when Britain was first established, it was established by Rome with the first monarch. And the monarch of Britain in 597 was actually appointed by the Pope or coronated by the Pope's local, you know, bishop, cardinal, what have you. And so the king himself was the supreme leader of the church and state and appointed this, you know, or actually, let me back up. In 1509, and that was when George wanted his divorce, and he basically, from 1509 to 1547 or so, approximately, it took a little time for this complete swing away from the Catholic Church, where he established the Church of England. And so the king himself was the supreme leader of the church and state and appointed the Archbishop of the Canterbury, who was then later on the one to anoint and coronate the monarchs thereafter. So from this point, based on common law, this is when they actually started having a Bible as the basis of the common law. Because when did we have the Bible? We didn't even have a Bible until at least England didn't have one in English until the King James Version, right? And so you know, this was an evolving period, an evolving time. Let's look at before England became a kingdom under Rome. And what was the form of law in England up until the establishment of the English church? what laws were under, you know, in control of England and all of Europe, 597 and up until that point. It was civil law. It wasn't common law, because Rome instituted and basically lived by the Roman law or civil law. So in other words, England kind of broke away from civil law, where France was still actually practicing civil law, where in England it was common law. They went back towards a biblical law, and it wasn't until the Bible was printed that helped everybody go, oh, okay, so now we have a biblically based law. Well, when was that? Again, that was around the 1547 time frame, where it was kind of galvanized. And it wasn't even galvanized until the King James Bible had been, you know, canonized. And then it took a while for them to understand. So we're talking 1547. Here's the question I have. When was common law clarified in Blackstone's commentaries? So Blackstone wrote his commentaries in the 1700s, about 200 years later, on basically helping everybody understand how common law and the biblical foundation of common law in England was to work. Now, in America, when America was founded, or I should say when we revolted, we cast off that, but we maintained common law. But did we maintain common law based on the Bible? No. Technically, the way common law worked back in the very beginning, we did maintain this biblical common law at the state level. At the state level, we maintained that. And then as things started to grow and we basically realized the Articles of Confederation were going to completely fail. I don't know who's calling me. They'll have to wait. But when we're looking at the evolution of our government from the Articles of Association, and this is why we covered all of this, right? At the ratification point of the Constitution, we declared in that Constitution that the supreme law of the land was to be what? Not the Bible. And this is why. Because by the time the framers were framing this amalgamation of 13 states, they realized that they actually had 13 states that were practicing different religions. And as a matter of fact, I can break it down for you. Virginia was the Anglican. New York was Anglican. Massachusetts was Congregational. Maryland, Anglican. Delaware was Christian non-denominational. Connecticut was Congregational. New Hampshire was Congregational. Rhode Island was Christian non-denominational. South and North Carolinas were Anglican. And the Georgia was Protestant. Pennsylvania was Christian non-denominational. And then New Jersey was Protestant. So, I mean, you didn't really have a real majority where the Anglican Church was the dominant one. And as a matter of fact, the concept of maintaining the Anglican Church in America was just tough. I mean, there was a lot of people that said, we do not want to still fall under that authority because of the link to the king. So they said, you know, and it came out this simply, whose Bible are we going to go by? Are we going to go by the Congregational? Are we going to go by the Puritans? Are we going to go by, you know, the Baptist? Whose Bible? Because everybody started, you know, rewriting the Bible and changing the doctrines of their church to mean different things. This is where we started splitting. And they said, hold on here. If we go down that path, then there's a high likelihood that we're actually going to start, you know, religious wars in America, especially because it's ingrained into the law. Well, actually, what we want to do is we want people to be free to practice whatever religion they want, whatever Christian faith they want. And so they said, okay, well, the federal government will not canonize that, but each state maintains their own religion. And this is why Virginia didn't separate themselves from the Anglican Church until 1830, New York, 1846, Massachusetts, 1833, Maryland, 1867, after the Civil War, Delaware, 1792, And Connecticut, 1818. New Hampshire, 1877. They were one of the last. They were the last of the original 13 that basically separated or stopped of having a direct affair with the church. In other words, the reason that there were these state-sponsored churches is because the states maintained this thing called welfare. I'll call it compassionate services, because this is where welfare, education, and those types of things were being provided to the people. So as we kind of look at how they had to move forward, they couldn't use the Bible because they knew that all the Bibles weren't the same. And so all of these people today that you hear talking about a biblically based, you know, the Bible is based, you know, the foundation of our law. No, the Constitution is the foundation, and it was framed in such a way that allowed people to live and have the opportunity to live and express themselves by their own faith. And so when we look at common law today, this is why this is so important. Common law, when we actually go into common law court, it is not to be based on the Bible, because the Bible has been, I'll just say, reinterpreted so many different ways that we can't create a standard. So the standard was and was designed to be the Constitution. And again, it was designed to actually give jurisdiction, very specific jurisdiction, to the governing bodies. So at the national level, the jurisdiction of the federal body of government was based on those things enumerated in the Constitution. This is why, and I've said this today, and I say this all the time, that if it's not enumerated, abortion, health care, education, environmental protection, I could go on and housing, labor, I could go on and on and on. It's not that they're not claiming jurisdiction. They have no authority to have that jurisdiction. Their jurisdiction is based upon Article 3, Section 2, all things arising under this Constitution and treaties under their authority. In other words, they can't make up their jurisdiction. They're hamstrung. They are forced to actually stay within those boundaries. But when you come along and say, hey, we want you to resolve this suit over CO2 or over this environmental issue, the court, oh, sure, because they make money, everything that they bring in. You know what? Maybe we should have the court, and I know that I'm going to get a couple of calls from some people, hey, that's a great idea. Maybe we should have the court restore the money over cases that they took and they charged for the hearing of that case when they had no jurisdiction. Maybe we should make a law, because technically, there's no such thing as reparations. I say this all the time. You can't, you know, if government is doing something wrong, we can't get them to pay, you know, for their wrongdoing. But what we can do is we can fix it, just like slavery. We can fix it and move forward on the right principles. The problem was when we fixed slavery because of the Civil War, there were too many other people that had their fingers, you know, in different pies and too much power that they were not willing to give those powers up and that control. And so what they wanted to do was they wanted to maintain a way to keep us divided. Just imagine how America would be today if we weren't divided over race, over gender, or I should say sex, over, you know, over religion and all of these other things. If we were all united on the rule of law, where would we be? How much are you contributing to the division of America? Are you a part of an organization? Now, think about this. Are you part of an organization that actually divides people? What I mean by that is, do you belong to an organization that is a direct contributor to what I'll say is a divisive organization? Now, there are organizations out there like, you know, the parties that are direct and I literally mean that, direct dividers. In other words, they're out there to deliberately divide us over issues. They call them factions. And so when we look at this division that comes under the party, we have people that have subdivisions of over the issues. I'll give you a good case in point. Abortion. Abortion's a very hot issue, and that's one of those issues that gets everybody divided. I'm for it and I'm against it. Well, actually, it doesn't matter whether you're for or against. Why do we even care? We just say that it's not authorized by the government to regulate one way or the other. The federal government has no authority to be involved or to hear that issue. So then it has to be settled at the state. And here it comes down to this. Are we to allow, because prior to abortion, because see, the laws before were to protect life. Then all of a sudden they said, hey, we're at a point where we now want to take life. We want to take this innocent life. Margaret Sanger and this idea of, you know, eugenics and everything that she was all about. Well, she, you know, introduced this evil paradigm. Well, the question is, if the law and the whole purpose of government is to protect life and property, and the government, their state government, has not been granted the authority to authorize the taking of an innocent baby, an unborn baby, then how is it your state was able to assume that they could do that? There was a collusion between the federal government and the state government, and they started playing games. And that's why Roe v. Wade actually, you know, they crossed the line and they said, you know, we're going to mandate this. We don't have any jurisdiction, but we're going to unconstitutionally mandate that abortions can be done. So when we look at the law, where should that case have been actually aired? Where should that case have been heard first? Well, it should have been heard at the county, and it should have been heard in a common law court. And that common law court would be focused on the Constitution. So, excuse me, what I'm trying to say, and I got to get a drink. I very rarely do this, but forgive me for having to pause. Anyway, I'm sure everybody understands that I have some issues, but anywho, mental issues, obviously. But the point is that this is why we need somebody with the mind and the understanding of the Constitution to give us, for our framework and our form of government, the Blackstone commentary of a Republican form of government, common law, based upon the Constitution being the supreme law of the land. Then we need to have somebody kind of go through. But see, here's the problem. Almost everybody that I've read that's written books on common law, they equally tie it to the Bible. I'm sorry. It's nice, it's noble, but it's all based on the theocratic monarch of England. Now, that's not the government we have. So why is it that we've got patriots, good, righteous patriots, that want to cling to, and because it's, to me, it's deceptive, and it makes people think that we have a government that's different. And it gets people to start thinking, well, you know, this is so out of whack because nobody has actually taken the time to really look and understand what we have as a government and how the monarchical, or I should say the magistrate framework, is gone. It's been obliterated in our government. This is why the Jural Assemblies, the Sovereign Citizen Movement, all of these different movements are benefiting from the fact that we are being divided. We're actually being given bad information, and we're convincing people that they need to take this course of action, that they need to go down this path and say, hey, You know, we have the sheriff is the most powerful guy. Hey, sheriff, you can stop all of this. When the sheriff actually doesn't have the jurisdiction or authority in our constitutional process. In other words, who has the ultimate authority in our government? That would be we the people and our representatives. When we look at who actually carries the power, the sovereigns were referred to as the legislators. In every step of the way from framing that constitution, they constantly referred to the sovereigns as the representatives. Sovereigns of the state were the state legislature. Sovereigns of the federal government were Congress. How is it today that the courts, the judges in courts, have been deemed the sovereigns? I'll tell you how. Because we refer to them as magistrates. And a magistrate is the sovereign entity. But technically, the judges, actually, they're handstrong. They're handstrong on what they can do, and they're handstrong on, you know, their jurisdiction as well. So understanding all of this and going through this is really paradigm. This is why, when you read Why Counties Matter Most, it'll help you really understand what we have to do to restore your county. You need to demand your county representation back. We need to actually get to a point where we actually have a petition to actually go after that very particular ruling that came from SCOTUS back in the 1960s, and it was basically invoked by every state or within every state by 1970 or 1971. Every state had completely reformed themselves based on democracies. And this has been the biggest deception that America has ever dealt with from the court system. They had no authority to hear that case. And I go through all of this and why counties matter most. You know, I'm not the brightest bulb in the world. I'm not. But it only takes a little bit of research and understanding of the Constitution to say, well, that doesn't jive. And so everything I identify of how the federal government started aggrandizing its role in admitting and this responsibility of admitting new states into the union and how they started, you know, quickly assuming that they could start taking latitude in states and state property. And next thing you know, by the time the western states came along, those states had very little property. They were big states and, oh, you don't need all that property anyway. No, a state is a state is a state. In other words, the boundary of that state creates a sovereign body where it possesses and has full control over everything within that state. And that state is to be governed based on the constitution that has been established by the representatives of the people. The people. Not the court. Not the federal government. Not the adjoining states, the people of that state. And so when you read, folks, if you've never read your Constitution, especially if you're in a Western state, the one thing that should actually make you sick is this concept that you're an inseparable part of the Union, that you cannot leave the Union. That is an absolute conflict with the whole idea of the Constitution of becoming a state. No one has the authority to compel you or the state within this constitutional framework to be able to stand up and say, hey, you have no business doing this, and if you persist in doing this, we're leaving. We're done. Because that's what the southern states did, and they had the right to do that. And Lincoln should have responded properly, but instead he responded as an unconstitutional tyrant. Quit glorifying these men. He didn't save the Union. He perverted it further. All he did was he did a good thing called ending slavery, but that wasn't his intent. It wasn't until he, you know, was so humbled because he couldn't win a battle. He hadn't even won a battle in the first 2 years. It took that prostrating of himself and humbling to actually seek and hear, you know, the probably the wisest man in his milieu, which was Douglas, right? Frederick Douglass was the one that kept on telling him, you need to make this war about slavery. And so that's what he finally did with the Gettysburg Address, folks. You know, I'm not the brightest bulb. I am absolutely humbled. I can't tell you how humbled I am in helping support so many great patriots across this great nation that I have this opportunity to serve and to do his work in helping you. And my only desire is that we become more efficacious in reclaiming the republic. And the only way we can do that is we have to understand what we're doing. You have to understand what has to happen. You have to understand the importance of interposition and how that Constitution was defined. In empowering you with all of the information so that you can do the right thing, that's a beautiful gift. That's a very beautiful gift, and it's for you to take. You're more than welcome to have this. I'm not here trying to make money by going around and speaking, and I'm not going to start selling some products. I mean, after all this is said and done, I'd love to go out and start manufacturing or providing some really unique products that I would love, and I think there's a lot of people out there that would really love them too. Would I copyright them and patent them? I have a book. I have a book that I published back in 2013, and, you know, I printed, you know, so many of them, and I haven't sold all of those. But the question is, should I maintain my copyright for that book? Well, the copyright for the book, once you've bought that, you know, trademarks are one thing, they expire. But actually, a trademark, if you maintain yourself, there's no real reason why, other than the fact that the government has created a scam on trademarks that says, yeah, you know, you need to pay. It's like payola. Right, you got to pay them to keep playing, to basically have. But once you've created some artwork, then that artwork, once you've said that is unique artwork that nobody has, and they acknowledge that that's something unique, that nobody's doing what you're doing, then why is it that that can expire? Why do trademarks like that and what you do as a trademark expire? It's about money. They're about making money. So anyway. Back to my book, you know, I honestly believe that that book should actually become free at a certain point. But the problem is I haven't even sold what I've, you know, all everything that I've, my first run. But I haven't been peddling it. So what do you do? I mean, it becomes the chicken and the egg thing. And so I have no desire to hide, but I have learned my lesson in not putting out a lot of money in printing when I can give you. I can actually just give you what you need to know. And that's why on Reclaiming the Republic, you can find all of the articles for free, all of these petitions for free. You don't have to pay to take your country back. And I think it's repugnant that there are people that say they're a patriot, but you got to pay them to be able to, you know, learn some little tidbit. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.